end result of that was really that these six counties said we really need to embrace smart growth. This whole area comes from an agricultural tradition. Preserving their ag land is extremely important. They're located in the fertile Central Valley of California. All of the cities in that area have a tradition of just continuing to expand outward and outward because they've got flat developable land, and that's the path of least resistance. So basically each of these counties, each of the communities within those counties decided that three things needed to happen. They needed to focus more on infill development and redevelopment, they needed to look at higher density development, and they needed to promote transit. And based on the million projection, each jurisdiction was then given their regional share of what they needed to accommodate to make this work. As it turns out, Sacramento's share of that was approximately 200,000 new residents, 140,000 new jobs by 2030. So that's the context in which Sacramento began to undergo its general plan process about 3 years ago. Sacramento's always been historically important in California. It was the first incorporated city within California, incorporated in 1849, right after the discovery of gold. It is located on the Sacramento and American rivers. It functions both as the center of the region as well as a state capital. So it plays a lot of roles in the state and in the region. So in beginning to look at how you begin to rethink the urban form of a city that's going to add 200,000 people, we started at the macro scale and looking, first of all, what are those sort of framework elements that really begin to both give character but also constrain what's happening in the city of Sacramento? And at this scale, we've really identified a number of factors. As I mentioned, there are the two rivers. There's the American River and the Sacramento River that come down. These are both important historically because they were transportation routes. They're more recreationally important as both boating amenities and land use amenities. But they also happen to be real physical constraints and political constraints, particularly after the revelations of Katrina and what can happen when you have massive levee failure. Most of the city of Sacramento is well below the 100-year flood stage, and so this is a consideration. If you continue to grow outward and outward and along the river, what are the implications of that? In addition, you also have the rail, both heavy rail and light rail, which begin. Heavy rail really did set the form of Sacramento in its early stages. This was the western terminus of the National Railroad. This was also the terminus of the Pony Express. So the city grew up around that rail. Now they have a light rail system, and the city is beginning to look like, how can we begin to restructure ourselves around that light rail system? And then finally, you have the road system, which you can see begins to carve up the city in some very interesting ways, and as illustrated in the photo down here, begins to create some physical barriers within the community that are less than positive. We then look at the historical patterns, because this actually was very revealing, as it turned out, of what the physical form used to be. Sacramento initially started with a master plan in 1849 that laid out a very nice urban grid. 320 by 340 foot blocks, mid-block alley, and every 12 blocks there was a public park. So it was a very nice plan upon which to start. It wasn't completely realistic. In fact, there was a marsh in here, and none of this ever occurred. But it was well platted. And this is what the city looked like around 1860, stretching down to the riverfront, which is since been cut off by freeways and no longer connects directly to the waterfront. Looking at the growth patterns begins to show really what happens in terms of the urban form. This is very hard to see, but from 1849 to 1950, the first century, you can see here's the central core. It essentially tripled in the first 100 years. From 1850 to 1970, or from 1950 to 1970, you can see the city went on a huge binge of annexation. And in fact, the population growth between here and here and between here and here was about the same. It wasn't that they actually filled up all that area. They just got very aggressive and said, we're going to grow and we're going to annex all this. This sort of pattern of expansion and suburbanization, as it turned out, is reflected in the urban patterns. So after looking at the city on this large scale, we began to look at a more detailed scale to identify what the existing pattern of development is now. One of the things that came out of the visioning process for the general plan update was that the city adopted as their vision statement that they wanted Sacramento to be America's most livable city. Slight amount of hubris in that, I suppose, but a valid and interesting goal. And so obviously they like what they have, and the question that we wanted to find out is, what in fact is that that you like? And so part of going through the exercise of identifying urban form patterns and neighborhood characters and district characters was to begin to create a vocabulary for the community to talk about what it is they liked, what it is that they thought could change about their community to actually make it more livable. Just as a process, what we did is we went through basically looking at the city from about 10,000 feet to begin to identify visually what kind of patterns we were beginning to see in the landscape. 100 square miles, you're not going to get down and do a detailed block-by-block analysis. So what we did is we did this quick survey, then we took 100-acre samples from the city and really began to focus on four different patterns that were easily identifiable from aerial photographs. First of all, we looked at the street pattern, the grids. We then counted the number of intersections. We looked at the number of through streets, and we looked at the figure ground to actually look at the pattern of building within that. And out of this, we came up with a system of about 16 different land use or neighborhood types. And I'll just flash through these, and you can begin to see the black and white graphics sort of vividly show the difference that occurred from time. So we're starting, this is the historic downtown, very nice regular grid of streets. Then gradually that grid began to warp out a little bit, and then gradually get more and more suburban and less connected. And then looking at commercial corridors, the commercial corridors within the historic area, and then the more suburban corridors, and you can begin to see the development pattern, the difference in development pattern. Looking at commercial retail centers, so you can get a sense, that, again, the CBD versus a regional commercial center, the differences in development patterns. From here, then, we took each of these areas, these 16 areas, and began to look at them in more detail, and we delved down into them to further examine, you know, what was the character of the block, what were the sizes, what were the configurations, then what were the street characters, down to, you know, how many curb cuts are there, how many travel lanes are there, what are the widths of the right-of-way, and then down to the building and site character. So, you know, what was the relationship of the building to the street, how tall were the buildings, what sort of site coverage was there. So for each of these 16 areas, we really did create a profile that described what made them distinctive. And then we mapped those areas. So these basically are the residential prototypes that we identified in their distribution. And again, you can begin to see how they reflect the historic pattern. So your more traditional are in the yellow, and then as you, well, this is the town core, the original town core. The yellow represents the next generation. The orange represents the suburban sprawl generation. And then also looking at the non-residential component, the commercial industrial uses within the community and their distribution. Once we identified these various urban form types and talked to the community about, you know, this is what you have, what do you want to keep, what do you want to change, the question became, how do we then take these 200,000 additional people, 140,000 additional jobs, and distribute them within the community? The typical suburban city, and even non-suburban city, the answer has always been, well, where's our available land, or where do we get more available land, and let's build out on that. We'll either annex it if we have to, or just continue the way we've been going. But in a smart growth strategy that the city has adopted, they needed to say, okay, well, where can we find land within the city with minimal amount of new greenfield development that can actually accommodate this? And this is just a graphic to begin to show the growth scenario that they've adopted. First of all, it goes towards strong infill in the CBD. They have a central city, basically, that has a lot of redevelopment potential, so they're focusing a great deal of growth there. They've also then identified the concept of an urban center or a sub-regional center. Now, this is a prototype that didn't exist before, and it's not one that exists in the city now. And so it was one that was introduced as an idea similar in concept, similar in urban form to the central business district, but less dense. So whereas the central business district had buildings that may be up to 40, 50 stories tall, these sub-regional centers would then focus on buildings that might come up to 25 stories, so that they're really sort of the mid-rise to low high-rise, but begin to create a series of four different nodes around the central city that begin to distribute vehicle trips, population, jobs, shopping, so that you begin to create a much different pattern than, rather than having all your commute trips come into the downtown, you begin to have a pattern where they're going back and forth, and people can live and commute in different patterns, making fuller use of the transit opportunities. And then, in addition to those centers, the recognition of the city's light rail system and creating a whole series of transit station centers, which now are currently based primarily on a suburban model, which have surface parking lots around them, oftentimes not residential, but office or non-residential uses around them. So the idea of transforming these transit centers into mixed-use, higher-density, transit-oriented development centers. And then a couple areas of small new greenfield development, and then a couple larger areas of urban reserve that says, you know, out beyond 2030, these are areas that we might begin to consider for additional growth if, in fact, we need to do that. The next step from the growth scenario was begin to look at how you take their existing urban form prototypes and the new urban form types that they've identified, the urban centers, the transit centers, and begin to turn those into a series of land use classifications. In Matt's terminology, that they would be the same as place types. And these are really seen as a combination of urban form and land use. While we're trying to move beyond land use, it's also the community felt it was very important that you not completely divorce the idea of land use from certain districts. This is a very well-established community, and they wanted to make sure, particularly in their residential neighborhoods, that they weren't being vague about what could actually happen in those. And so we've come up with a series, and obviously a more detailed series of land uses than in a smaller community like Southgate. So we actually have 10 different neighborhood districts, 5 different center districts, 2 different corridor districts or designations, and then a series of different districts relating to special use types. This is just a detail showing the way that that begins to lay out. Again, you can begin to see that it's more detailed and not as generalized, because the city really was concerned about both recognizing existing uses on the ground as well as where they wanted to go in the future. And I think this is an interesting question about how you apply form-based planning to an existing city, recognizing that some areas are going to change and that the city wants to change, and then other areas need to stay the same, and how you need to be careful to calibrate your urban form types to respond to whether you're looking for a lot of change or not. You don't want to create a situation where you're applying an urban form type that makes 90% of what's in that area non-conforming. Particularly if you want that kind of use to continue. So, and clearly, one of the things we needed to do then, once we had developed, particularly these new urban form types, corridors was one of the areas that they really have miles and miles of suburban corridors that are just lined with little pod malls and strip malls. And one of the directions of the plan is to begin to transform these into mixed-use corridors, some very high urban densities and some more moderate densities. But for each of these new prototypes that we were talking about, we needed to begin to create some graphics that very generally talked about, you know, what might these look like so that the public actually understood what the transformation might begin to look like. These are, you know, we then just plugged these into aerial photographs to begin to show a sense of what the texture would be like and how you would transition from the corridor to adjoining neighborhoods, or in a transit location, how you would begin to include higher density development around a transit station, and then feather that out, including retail, or into the existing community. What a sub-regional center might begin to look like in terms of its bulk and how it would transition. Also, what new mixed-use development areas might look like to begin to demonstrate that they didn't have to look exactly the same as the suburban sprawl that they had in their other greenfield areas. And then looking at the downtown, this happens to be the rail yards area, huge area, 3,000 acres. This is the CBD, immediately adjacent to the downtown that's scheduled for redevelopment, what that might begin to look like, how it begins to relate to the river. And one of the things you can begin to see here is that most of these building models we did at this scale were really just simple blocks and fairly conceptual. In the downtown itself, WRT, Solomon ETC, has been working on a related process that's going on concurrently with the general plan. It's really looking at urban design guidelines for the CBD. And as part of that, we've been looking at how to begin to visualize density. And we've been developing prototypes that fit specifically into the block pattern in the downtown. So we took the 320 by 340 block and began to show a series of building prototypes and how they would actually fit and what kind of density they would get. So just a couple examples showing, you know, two-story tuck under, the kind of density you would get. And then showing within that block, you know, how it would work. Wouldn't work in an eighth of a block situation, but from a quarter block up to a full block situation, what kind of density you would get from that. What this allowed us to do was then to begin to work with the city's GIS to apply a SketchUp model to that, to begin to show what changes would begin to look like as you add density to the downtown. This is the existing development pattern in the downtown. These happen to be pipeline projects, and so we began to plug those in so that the city could begin to see what the effect of their pipeline projects is. One of the things that's driving this process is that all of a sudden Sacramento has gotten to a point in its urban history where they're getting proposals for 50-story buildings, whereas now their current building is about, tops out about 30 stories, and most of it is much below 20. So all of a sudden, and these buildings are all residential in character. Before, they had practically no residential downtown. So anyway, moving from there then to begin to look at a series of scenarios about height limits and what the implications might be, we began to plug in the prototypes that I just showed you to how you could achieve density within certain height limits, looking at various opportunity sites within the downtown. So here's one scenario, here's another scenario, and here's another scenario. So you could very quickly begin to get a sense of what the physical implications of what are pretty abstract terms to people. A 50-story building, you know, a density of 300 units per acre doesn't mean much, but to be able to see it in three dimensions is quite effective. And then obviously one of the benefits of working in this format is you can begin to spin around and look at it at different elevations so that you can begin to show the different effects of that. And the reason I just end with that is just to say how important it is, if you're talking about urban form and community character, to begin to provide the visual tools that allow the community to see what it is you're talking about, what the transformation is going to be when you move from current conditions to proposed future scenarios. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Now we're moving to the East Coast, to Southeast Florida. Marcella Tambor from the Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council will talk about a county, which is at the northern part of Southeast Florida's region.
Thank you, Jim. Yes, those were my dogs. Sorry. The comprehensive plan element that I'm about to show you is has been called the Towns, Villages, and Countryside, or the TVC, and it is a new element for a comprehensive plan for a portion of a county in the Treasure Coast region called St. Lucie County. And now, what's interesting about this story, it is a very courageous comprehensive plan and instead of rules and regulations that this county has adopted. But for those of you that are not from Florida, St. Lucie County has always been treated as the stepchild of the region. Every time we had to point to sprawl or bad things happening, the first name that came out of your mouth was St. Lucie County. And just like other people in Florida say, we don't want to be like Dade or Broward, in our region it's like, we don't want to be like St. Lucie County. It was, you know, the example of everything bad. This new element of a comprehensive plan, the TVC, is very graphical. So it is pioneer in many, many different ways. And I think it's going to be the beginning of many comprehensive plans that we're going to be seeing in the future that, again, because they are very graphical, they're probably going to, I'm sure, start to be called form-based comprehensive plans. You're going to see great similarities between form-based codes and this type of comprehensive plan that we have developed for St. Lucie County. The TVC codes all of the charter principles. All of the charter principles are at the level of the comprehensive plan, which is also a first for Florida. And it also uses the neighborhood as the basic planning tool, as the basic planning principle, and takes all the principles embedded in designing a neighborhood, expands it to create a master plan for a region. So those are, you know, those are very unique things about the TVC. By the way, all these computer-generated animations that you're going to see were done by ARC Solutions. They are exhibitors here, and they have been instrumental in helping the community understand really what was being proposed. We've figured out over the years that people really don't know how to read plans and get turned off very quickly. So all these animations are well worth it. And you know, I find it interesting. I was thinking about what happens and how excited we all get when we get the opportunity to come to CNU. You know, it's a great chance to come and talk about town planning endlessly and not having everyone be annoyed at you or think that you're a total nerd. And we were walking yesterday with Anthea from our office down the street, and it's interesting to see how everyone is really excited, taking pictures of all kinds of just very unique things, and how the people that are living in the city really stare at us new urbanists about the things we take pictures of. You know, I mean, a lot of us getting very excited about the super skinny streets, and others, you know, photographing trash cans. It's all kinds of interesting things that happen. But I just, you know, and over the last few weeks, and especially yesterday, I found myself, you know, just walking and smiling, because I think that for the first time in many, many years of doing new urbanism, I just kept thinking that we finally have a county in Florida where sprawl is illegal, period. No more gated communities, no more lack of connectivity, no more sprawl. It's just illegal. And the reason I was smiling yesterday is because only 3 weeks ago, our Department of Community Affairs found this comprehensive plan in compliance. The Department of Community Affairs and the county are getting ready to sign this. It's been challenged. We had, 2 years of challenge from property owners, so it's set a huge precedent. It's been challenged on every possible level. So we're excited, because we truly believe that other comprehensive plans in Florida that go the new urbanist route or the form-based route are going to have a very smooth process and a very smooth ride. For those of you that are not from Florida, St. Lucie County is on the East Coast, almost halfway, within that whole expansion of our eastern coast. And like I said before, it was the stepchild of the Treasure Coast region. The TVC, this new comprehensive plan, has only been done for a small area in northern county. The Board of County Commissioners is now in the process of expanding this comprehensive plan or doing a similar process for the entire county. But this was a test case for this new comprehensive plan. The area that the TVC encompasses is about 28 square miles. It's the area within the yellow boundary. The red line that you see is the county's urban service boundary. What's interesting is their old comprehensive plan said there shall be no islands. You know, the first thing we found was that this was the urban service boundary, and then there was an interesting island right here. This is I-95. I don't know if I can do this. And the Florida Turnpike. Let me do this. Just 1 second. I know this, there's a reason we put the dogs up here, and it was just to be able to do this. So I-95 is right here, Florida's Turnpike, Indria Road, and the ocean is that way. What's interesting is that even though about 70% of the area that we were looking at was outside the urban service boundary, it was under their old comprehensive plan, planned for a little over 22,500 residential units, so in the 28 square miles, or 18,000 acres, you do the math. And it was also planned for 41 million square feet of commercial space. For those of you who've been to Bob Gibbs' presentation, there's roughly 20 regional malls. I mean, there was no way you could physically put them there. But it was planned for that. I mean, whoever colored with the markers the previous land use plan just painted 41 million square feet of retail in that area. All along, the zoning there was for Ag 1. And all the people that had moved to that area were convinced, they had moved up north from Dade and Broward, they were convinced that they were buying into a rural lifestyle. When we started the charrette with a community back in 2004, when we got asked by the commission to go help them plan this area, one of the first exercises, one of the first things we did to show the community how big the area was, you know, because we can tell you planners and architects and designers, you know, what 28 square miles looks like, and you can probably picture it, or at least some of you probably can, but the community surely couldn't, and so we showed them how in that 28 square miles you could fit Renaissance Florence and historic Savannah and the north end of Boston and the lower end of Manhattan and still have a ton of open space. Because again, you know, they had this vision that you could only fit so many homes, you know, single story, of course, in Florida. Everyone's retired, so you don't sell two-story homes. And that there was really no room for anything other than probably five or six more subdivisions in the area. So this diagram went a long way for the community to understand the scale of the area that we were looking at. This is the comprehensive plan that the county had when we first got there. And it's probably very similar to the comprehensive plans you all have in your communities. And Matt talked about that. A lot of red, a lot of orange, a lot of blue. A lot of communities called this their vision, even though there's absolutely no vision attached to this. There was, of course, in all this orange out here, which is the area that we were mostly looking at, no plan whatsoever for green, for open space, for agriculture, for all the reasons the community had moved up to that area to begin with. It was all slated for RE, residential estate, at one unit to the acre, and again, the 41 million square feet of commercial.